Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. I'm your host, Nick Bilton, and I have with me a not very special guest. Are you typing, John, as you're talking to me?
No, I'm just lowering the volume to shut you up.
Okay, John Kelly. You know, that's like one of the golden rules of podcasting is you don't type when you're talking to someone. John Kelly, you are soon to be out of a job at the White House, but before we get to all that, I have a very special guest, Jason Fried, who is an incredibly thoughtful CEO, entrepreneur, who has a tech company not based in Silicon Valley. He's written several incredible books, and his latest book, which is really important for our relationship, John, is It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. It's about how technology is making us work like 80, 90, 100-hour weeks, and it's total bullshit. We don't actually have to do that. We can turn the technology off and tell our editors to go away and leave us alone. But afterwards, we're going to talk about a few things in the news. What are those things that we're going to talk about, John?
I think we'll probably talk about the latest Facebook revelations, how culpable they are, how much they're owning up to it. And the big news that's dropping right now is, of course, that Mattis is resigning, effective in February. It seems as Trump prepares to go to Mar-a-Lago for 16 days, all hell is breaking loose and the shit is hitting the motherfucking fan.
That should be the title of our episode. The shit is hitting the motherfucking fan. We're going to get to what's going on inside the White House because it seems like it's all just kind of falling apart in such a sad, happy way for the holidays and New Year. Anyway, let's jump to Jason and hear what he has to talk about. It's a great conversation. We end up getting into job loss and AI and you name it. Stick around, everyone, for the John Kelly and I after the show. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we have a lot to get to today. Thanks for flying all the way to LA just to come on to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. You have a new book out. Mm-hmm. What's it called?
It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work.
Which I'm not sure I believe, but you're going to convince me by the end of this podcast that I don't actually need to do the podcast. I don't have to work or anything. Before we get to all that, so you've been in the tech world for how long?
Well, since at least 99. We launched our business in 99.
And you didn't die with the tech bubble back then?
No.
How did you survive?
How did we survive it? Well, we had a few bubbles, I guess, 2001, 2008. I mean, we just kept our company small. So back in 99, we were four people. And so, you know, it doesn't take much to keep four people going.
So we had lunch a couple of months back, and I remember saying to you, you know, your company's done really well, Basecamp. It's grown. You have 58 employees now or something like
that. 55.
And I'm sure you have had acquisition offers, right?
Yeah.
Why not just sell the company and, like, go live on the beach or something?
Because I don't want to live on the beach. I like to work. You know, I like to do my thing. I like to build a company. I like to build the product. I like to work with the people I work with. I like to have a job.
Yeah.
And I basically have created this company. I've created the job I want to work at.
And
so why would I want to get rid of it?
You still enjoy it?
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the question. You're not in Silicon Valley.
Right.
Does that help you? I mean, it seems like if you were in Silicon Valley, you would have a different mindset where you'd be like, yeah, I want to make $1 billion and sell this to Google and not work.
I think it helps. I think it helps. We're in Chicago primarily, although we're remote, so we have people all over the world that work for us. But we're based in Chicago, so we're not part of that scene where we don't get sucked into all that behavior. Although it's, of course, everywhere now, so it doesn't really matter. Even companies in Chicago are trying to emulate Silicon Valley companies. So it's leaked out, unfortunately. But I've just, like, I don't want to work for someone else. I don't want to stop doing what I'm doing. I want to do this for 20, 30, well, we're 20 years in now, so like maybe I can do it for 40 years if I'm lucky. That'd be a great career for me. I'd be happy to do that.
All right, so let's get to your book and then we'll come back to all this stuff.
Yeah.
So you've written a few books and your latest one is essentially about the fact that we now live in a culture where people are constantly working. You know, the Steve Jobs bragging about the 80-hour work week. Everything's kind of melded together, you know, endless meetings, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to write this? And then I want to understand how you actually believe people can not work as much.
Yeah, sure. So, well, there's a trend going on, which we don't like, which is, you know, crazy hours, crazy work, and people bragging about it, bragging about lack of sleep, bragging about just endless work and this sort of culture of hustle. And the endless hustle, side hustles, hustles, the whole thing, right? So that's kind of going on right now, which we don't like. But I've been talking to friends over the last few years, just like, you know, how's work? How's it going? And everyone just said the same thing, like, it's crazy at work. I'm like, what do you mean it's crazy at work? What does that mean? And you dig into it and like, well, I'm super busy all the time. I'm like, super busy? I'm not super busy. What is super busy about? What does that even mean, super busy? Working 80 hours a week, working on the weekends, have conference calls on Sunday. I'm on vacation, but I have to call in every once in a while. I'm like, well, that's not a vacation if you're calling in. Like, that's not, you're still working, you know? So I just start hearing this from people. And of course, you see people bragging about working forever. And we don't work that way. We've never worked that way. And I just thought it was time to share our point of view on this, which is that we think that's fucking crazy to work that way and to always be on and always be available and have the expectation of immediate response whenever someone asks you a question. You got to get back to them instantly. I just don't think it's healthy. And I think there needs to be a counterpoint. So we're that counterpoint.
So there's two things there. One is that technology has made it so, you know, you can expect that someone's going to be here instantly and you can text them and they're going to respond, right? It's funny. So I in Hollywood, when you call like an agent or like someone, you know, you're interviewing for a story or something, they always say, it's really funny, they still act like it's like 1980 and they're like, I can't get that person right now. I don't know where that person is. Let me see if I can find them. And it's like, no bullshit. You actually do know where the fuck they are because they have a phone and they have text messaging and they have email and all these things. And yet they pretend that they live in this other world. But I can't do that. If my editor emails me and is like, hey, I need you to hop on this call or something, what am I going to do? Say, I can't get Nick right now?
You could say, I'm busy. I'm doing something else. Like, I think the thing is technology has made it easy to reach out, but you don't have to accept that handshake instantly. Like, you can say, like, someone sends you a text. If someone sends me a text, like, I don't, because it took them a second to send it, doesn't mean I need to get back to them in 1 second. I get back to them when I have a free gap in my day where I look at my phone and go, oh, there's some messages waiting for me. So I think it's about how you receive right now the sender is in control. The sender sets the terms, the sender sets the medium, in fact. And I think that if you flip that and go, look, this is my time that you're asking for. This is my time you want. This is my answer you want. I'll give it to you when I'm ready. Everything ends up working out all right. Like, if you tell your editor you can't get on this call right now, or hey, I'm unavailable, what about tomorrow at 3? They'll be like, okay, that's fine. Let's do it tomorrow at 3.
But you
we assume that everyone's like, has to have everything right now, but like, you can say no.
Hey, if my editor's listening, just don't call me for a few days, okay?
Yeah.
You said at your company, you have like a 40-hour work week that everyone works?
But 8-hour days.
Now, what percentage of that is tied to the fact that you choose not to work an 80-hour work week? If you had decided like, okay, everyone, I'm going to be there 7 days a week, you know, won't your employees follow suit?
Yes. And that's the key, is I think you set the tone as the leader or one of the leaders. And so an executive, like, if it's crazy at work, it's because the executive likes it being crazy at work, or the CEO or the whatever, owner. They set the tone and people follow. And so, you know, I work 8-hour days roughly, sometimes less, oftentimes less, and that's enough. Like, it's just enough.
So how does someone listening to this podcast who's not the CEO convince the CEO to work less?
Well, I think at some point, you know, you got to figure out which battles you're gonna. Although I hate using that term too.
I was about to go to that.
Yeah, because we talk about that
in the book.
So that's, I don't want to say that, but I think, you know,
you have to pick which garden to cut.
Let's say which grass to cut, trim. I mean, you got to figure out, like, why are we working this amount of hours, and what is it doing to your employees? Like, there's actually science on this now. Like,
what is the science?
Well, like, I don't have the studies in front of me, so it's hard to quote the science.
Just make them up. No one cares.
Basically, you know, after a certain point, like after it's about 8 or 9 hours of actual work, which you're not even doing anyway when you work 8 hours, you're not really doing 8 hours work, but it's just like, it drops off a cliff. You're not as creative anymore. You're not as thoughtful anymore. You're not as patient anymore. You can't sustain that level of focus for that amount of time. So this 80-hour work weeks, which are like 10, 12-hour days, essentially, depending on how you actually add it all up and if you work weekends and some days are longer, you're not actually getting that much more work done. You're probably scrambling a lot. The amount of time you're putting in is probably not as valuable as if you just were focused on a shorter amount of time. So I think you can make some simple cases there, but I wouldn't start with the 80-hour work week case. I wouldn't say like, we need to work 40 hours, because that's going to be a hard thing to do. I'd look at the things that are causing the 80-hour work week, which is primarily not that there's more work to do, it's that there's more interruptions during the day, and my day is broken up into these smaller and smaller and smaller chunks of time, which make it really difficult for me to, I'm saying as if I was the employee, to actually focus on anything. I'm being bounced around. People are pulling me away from work every 15 minutes. I've got a meeting. I got a conference call. And like, I don't have time to actually do the work I'm supposed to be doing, which is why I'm working 80-hour weeks. So can we cut back on the interruptions? Can we figure out a way to structure our day where we have at least 2 or 3 hours of contiguous time to ourselves? Maybe in the afternoon, maybe we can try this one day a month. Like maybe the first Thursday of the month, no one talks to each other, or the afternoon is totally open for each individual person. No meetings can be scheduled, whatever, and let's see what happens. And I think people are going to go, I liked that day. I want more of
those
days.
That's a good idea. I like the idea of like scheduling a day where no one talks to each other, or there's no meetings. I once had a couple of years ago, I had a meeting at a tea house, like a Japanese tea house, and I was slammed at work, and I rushed out to the tea house, and I get there, and I text the person. They say, oh, I'm sitting in the back right corner, and they were like, our meeting's next week. And I was like, well, I'm already here. I may as well have some – I'd already ordered tea. And it was like the nice – I still remember this one-hour meeting I had to myself like 2 years later. And I said to myself at the time, oh, I'm going to start scheduling meetings where I just have meetings with myself.
Right.
Of course, does not happen. Yeah. But
your imaginary friend, Nick and Bill.
My imaginary friend, Nick. We have a great conversation.
Yeah.
But it seems like that we probably did that back in the day, and now we don't. But the question I have is, the constant interruptions are all a result of technology. You know, Slack, for
primarily,
example.
Primarily,
right? Slack is like my – you know, I try not to look at it quite often at work because, you know, during the day, because it's just like, what am I accomplishing by doing that? And things, you know, there's this software that is supposed to be helping make a work life better, but I feel like it's making it worse.
Yeah, there's a few things. So I think one of the worst inventions is the shared calendar. So the fact that in most businesses, everyone else can see everyone else's calendar and you can go pick off some time from someone else is actually a terrible thing. At Basecamp, no one can see anybody else's calendar. I can't see anyone else's. No one can see mine. If I want someone's time, I have to ask them for it. I have to say, hey, are you available next week at 3 on Thursday or whatever? And they can say yeah or no, versus me looking at a grid of boxes and trying to play Tetris and trying to figure out like where the space is and then claiming it and sending an invitation and having the request for time be so automated and so systematized that it feels like it takes all the human interaction out of it. And then we just kind of trade chunks of time with each other all day. And I think it's really dangerous. So I think that when you have a shared calendar and you can invite people, and of course you can say they can reject the invitation, but nobody does that. You end up creating a system where people are just taking each other's time. But if you thought of that time, like companies always go time is money, like everyone always says this, right? You would not allow people just to take money off people's desks, you know, but we're letting people take time from each other. And I think that's really unfortunate. So there's that. There's the shared calendar, which makes it easy to take other people's time, which means you don't really own your own day. Other people can take it away from you. And then tools like Slack and other sort of real-time communication tools where there's basically a conveyor belt that's going by in time. And if you're not paying attention to that as it passes your station, essentially, you can't get your word in. And if you don't do that, then you're missing out on the opportunity to have a discussion. And so you're paying attention in real time to many different conversations all day long while they're scrolling by, keeping one eye on the chat room, one eye on your work. It's very disruptive, and you can't really focus if you're doing that.
One thing that I found with as an author is when I speak to other authors, I always ask them, what is it that they – how do they write? Because, you know – that's a time where when you're interrupted or you procrastinate or whatever it is, it's the most difficult thing. And, you know, I remember everyone has these things where they like unplug their router or they turn their phone into airplane mode. Or I intentionally go to coffee shops that don't have cell service or Wi-Fi so that there's no interruptions.
Right.
Do you suggest people do that, where they kind of get off the internet, that perpetual procrastination machine?
Yeah. I mean, look, it's your time. This idea that our time is available to everybody else because of technology, I think, is busted. It's your time. It's your day. Turn your shit off.
But do you think...
Turn your shit off. Like, what's going to happen? Like, the only thing that's going to happen is if there's a true emergency, you're not going to hear about it. And that should happen, like, what, once a year? Maybe a true emergency? We're always worried about, well, what if my wife needs to get a hold... Like, yeah, these things can happen, of course. But they also could happen 20 years ago and, like, we were fine, too. So I just think that we don't need to ask permission to not be available. Just don't be available. The world's going to continue to go on. It's like people go on writing retreats, right? To get away. Or people go to the library and it's quiet. Like, why shouldn't everything be like that? Like, our office, for example, is like a library. We base our office, like, we do have a physical office in Chicago. And we have what we call library rules, basically, which is that...
oh my God, can I come work for you?
Yeah, please. But here's the idea. Like, everyone in the world knows how to behave in a library.
Yeah.
Cross cultures. You go to a library, it's quiet. Why is it quiet? Well, because people are studying and reading and thinking and learning. Isn't that what work should be? Isn't that what work
so what
is?
So what are your library rules?
The library rules is that the office is quiet. Like, you walk in the office, it's going to be very quiet, just like a library. If you want to talk to someone, you keep your voice down. Or you go get a room. We have special rooms set up where you can go and have a full volume conversation. And they're pretty much soundproof, not totally, but pretty close. But the idea is, like, you would behave like you behave in a library. You wouldn't go into a library and just talk really loud out in the middle of nowhere with seven people around a table. Like, that would be rude. It'd be disruptive to everybody else. So it's just think about a library and that then work that way. So, and it's fine. It works really well.
So one of the things that I to get back to this technology thing is that I feel like we're in a world where algorithms know us better than we know ourselves. And we are constantly kind of at war with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram that are trying to get us to engage with these things. And when I hear you talking about these things, do you really believe that there could be a world where we actually use technology less in the workplace?
No, I don't. Because I think that once the cat's out of the bag, it's out of the bag, basically.
So how, but by using technology, it's interesting. Like, well, Apple has this feature where you can get your text messages on every device, and it drives me insane because I forget that it's turned on and I'm like right in the middle of writing something and then all of a sudden there's this like giant stop sign in my face.
Yes. I think that, so technology, no, but like technology doesn't need to equal disruption and interruptions. Like, there's ways for technology to help us work quieter or deeper or whatever you want to say. And just one example from Basecamp, we have a feature in Basecamp 3, which is a current version of Basecamp called Work Can Wait. And it allows every person to set their own work schedules. Every employee who uses Basecamp, they're in control of their own work schedule. So they could say, I work from 9 to 5, or I work from 10 to 6, or I work from wherever. And outside of those hours, Basecamp cannot send you a notification. So you will not hear from work outside of these hours. So for me, I have Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and then off on the weekends. So I can go into the system and, like, if I want to look and see what's going on, but Basecamp cannot reach out to me. It's like in the old days, someone would hold your calls for you, basically, like hold my calls or whatever. That's what Basecamp's doing. So technology absolutely can help create boundaries. And this is available today in Basecamp, but there's also other methods of communication and the way the tools are built. So Slack, for example, or any sort of chat first kind of app, is built for people talking one line at a time, immediate response, instant sending, notifications racking up as one line it happens. And there's a time and a place for real-time communication for sure. But there are other tools. Basecamp is one, but also you can just look at email, which are more asynchronous. And they don't expect immediate responses. They're not designed in a way where they're immediate responses. They're longer form. They're more thoughtful, perhaps. And you write something, and the expectation is not you're going to get a line back. If you throw a line in, you're going to get a line back. Instead, you might throw a few paragraphs in and let someone read it over and get back to you later in the day. Like, there's just different expectations, I think, around email versus chat.
So
the tools can be designed in a different way and have a different ethos around, like, what's important and what kind of behavior do they want to encourage the users to take.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
Imagine a workplace with no distractions or disruptions. What a perfect topic for this perfect podcast. No endless searching to find the latest version of something. No constantly switching between apps. Now imagine a place where everything just flows. At Dropbox, they're creating a new home for all your team's work and the conversations around it, and a suite of tools that maximize inspiration and minimize distractions, all those pings and pongs and things that are trying to get you away from your computer to get your work done. That is all a thing of the past, because when teams are in flow, everything just clicks. Visit dropbox.com/flow to find out more. Dropbox keeps teams flowing. Once again, dropbox.com/flow. So speaking of tools, let's talk about Mark Zuckerberg. So, that's a good segue there. Mm-hmm. Thanks, folks. I'll be here all week. So one of the things you talk about in your book, which I hadn't actually thought about before, I just assumed that this was always the case, is that we live in an era now where CEOs use essentially war rallies to describe business. Like, it's, you know, you said it before, like, pick your battles, like, yeah, destroy your competitor. Like, there's like, I mean, I don't remember, but like some of
talent
them.
Talent war. Yeah. Like, you know, conquering the market, dominating a competitor, and there's all sorts of other ones. But yeah, there's a lot of them like that.
Is that a new thing that I didn't know about, isn't that unhealthy? I mean, if you constantly think of business as war, you're gonna be at it 80 hours a week, like, totally, in order to survive.
Of course. And in fact, it's funny. Like, today, so we have a podcast too called the Rework Podcast, and today we put an issue or an issue. That's funny. an episode out about this very topic, and we actually interviewed two professors who talked about the implication of using warlike language every day and how it really affects your psyche. And one example was Steve Jobs would talk about, like, enacting thermonuclear war on Android when Android came up. And it's like, when the leader of a group or an organization talks about thermonuclear war or destroying or taking or whatever, it's going to affect everybody, because in those situations, like in war, you know, morals go out the door. Everything goes, basically. It's survival.
Kill the children.
Kill the, whatever it is, right? Firebomb. Like, that's what happens in, yeah, war, right? The people aren't really, like, deciding who to kill necessarily in war. So I think that when you get into that mindset, you just think that you should do everything you possibly can to win. Otherwise, you will die. And so when it comes to business, there's antitrust issues, there's things you go and you sabotage, or there's things like Uber was doing with, you know, tracking journalists with that gray thing,
yeah,
I forget what it was called.
Ball. Yeah.
Right. And like, you do that because you have to win, and it's okay because it's a war. And that's a big fucking problem. It's a really big problem.
And
they also quote, like, Art of War, and everyone's reading all these war books and, like, the generals. And it's like, this is how we're going to run our business because we're out there fighting. It's like, no, you're not fighting, and you don't need to conquer anything.
But okay, so now the only way to change that is if everyone changes that. And that's, you know, we're not in, like, some sort of, you know, political drama on USA right now. Like, this is, like, real deal. Like, if Mark Zuckerberg treats his business like that, you know, his competitors can't not treat their business like that, right?
I don't know. Sure, you can. You can do whatever you want. It's your business. Like, there's a lot of competition in our industry. I mean, we're in the collaborative software world. There's a lot of competitors. Some of them may want to dominate the market. I don't care about dominating the market. I have no interest in dominating the market. We have a different cost structure. We have a different price structure. We have 100,000 companies that pay us every month for Basecamp. Like, we're in great shape. I don't need to have 1 million customers or 5 million customers or 10 million customers. I don't need to dominate anybody. I don't need to beat anybody. I don't need to take anyone's market share. There's plenty for us, plenty for everybody. So it's all about how you see yourself. I don't think that because your competitor does something, you have to do it the same way. I don't think you should, in fact. I mean, if you're gonna fight a war, there's only one winner, and usually there kind of isn't in many wars. But yeah, Let's say there is a winner, like, you're probably going to lose that if you're fighting a much stronger, bigger force with unlimited capacity. So why even fight? Why even go down that road? Why try?
Do you think that this is something that's endemic to Silicon Valley? Because you don't necessarily hear, you know, the guy who owns Barney's talking about thermonuclear war, right, on Saks. Like, is this something that is specific to the Valley technology?
I think it's become that way. I don't know where it started, although, like, you look at the leaders, like Steve Jobs, right? And he's talking about thermonuclear war, and everyone looks up to him. There's hero worship there. Elon Musk's like sleeping on the factory floor, and I don't know what language he uses, but I'm sure it's kind of warlike, and like we gotta, you know, everyone's out to get us.
Oh,
like,
the thing I'll never forget, he was talking about how hard it is to do a startup, and it's like eating broken glass, and and it's harder than firefighters, and it's like, fuck no. You, no, it's not.
Of course not.
Go fucking run into a burning building and tell me that's not harder.
Yes. Like, it's such bullshit. And it's such bullshit. So like, but people worship these guys for what they've done and what they've accomplished technically. And they have accomplished a lot. I'm not taking certain things away from them, but I think that's the wrong path for companies. And we've taken a different path. And so we did it. We're a small group of people in Chicago. We're doing great. Anyone can do this. And lots of people do, by the way. Like, there's lots of small businesses. There's lots of larger, slightly larger businesses that don't live the Silicon Valley world, that are still in the technology world.
I wonder if part of it, it's interesting, my wife and I have both been reading Thomas Piketty's Capital and talking about, you know, capitalism lately. And Tim Wu's book just came out, which is arguing against bigness. The idea that companies shouldn't aim to be the size of Facebook or, you know, multi-billion user companies. And I wonder if there will be a pushback at some point where we kind of encourage people not to have companies big.
I mean, we're pushing back on that hard. I mean, we're just one voice. But here's the thing, though. A big part of this is because of the financial structure of these organizations. So they take billions, they raise a bunch of money. In Facebook's case, I don't know what they end up raising, but like Uber's raised over $1 billion. Many of these companies have raised hundreds of millions of dollars. So the expectations are off the fucking charts. So what are you going to do? Like, the expectations are you must be enormous to pay these people back. You must be enormous to pay the investors back. And so it all begins there. If you go out and take a bunch of money, there's one path for you. Get as big as you possibly can or go out of business. That's it. Compared to, if you don't go take a bunch of money and you figure out how to do this on your own, there's a million different destinations along the way that are perfectly fine. When is running a $20 million business, when did that become like a shitty business? It's unbelievable that some people would say like, that's not big enough for me.
Well, that's just the Silicon Valley mentality, right?
Right.
Maybe we should just get rid of Silicon Valley and everything might be better, right?
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
So yeah. When you were writing this book, what was kind of the biggest revelation that you had?
Not when we were writing it. I don't think I had a revelation when we were writing it.
Because you already knew it all.
We knew that this is how we work and how we live. But yeah. It's more about when certain people read it and send you emails. So there's two types of emails because we have our email address in the back. It's like, so I always want to hear from readers. And they say like, either like, this is bullshit. There's no way.
That was the email I sent you.
Yeah, that's how we got together. So there's no way. And the other one is like, thank you for writing this because everyone told me I was fucking crazy because I only work 40 hours a week. So there's the affirmation, like there's someone else out there like me. And then there's the no way, impossible. There's also another group of emails, which is like you asked earlier, how do I get some of this going? Because we're not going to be able to change companies wholesale. So what kind of things can I suggest or can I pick off? And I was just suggesting like the No Talk Thursdays thing or something like that, just to get a little bit of traction and get some leverage. And so there's that. The other thing was that The whole publishing process is still
archaic.
Yeah, so there was that. That was a bit of a revelation. I thought it had changed over 10 years, but it really hadn't.
No, it's fascinating. You write a book and it, you know, you're like, oh, I'll see it on the bookshelf next week, and it's like, nope.
Yeah.
8 months later.
Yeah.
You're putting together the marketing plan and whatnot.
Yeah.
All right, so let's switch gears a little bit. You and I have talked before, and I talk about this on the podcast a lot, about social media. And, you know, one of the things, it's not really switching gears, this is kind of downshifting maybe. One of the things that I find really difficult is that we live in an era where you can know everything that's happening, and you feel kind of, and maybe it's just because of what I do for a living, but it probably isn't, but you feel kind of this responsibility to constantly know what's going on. And at the same time, you kind of look back at your day and you think like, what did I do today? And so I'm curious how you structure your time when it comes to like social media, and those distractions that leave you informed maybe or uninformed. I don't know. And how you balance that.
Yeah, I'm willfully ignorant about a lot of things. I don't pay attention to a lot of stuff. I'm not checking Twitter for news. I don't react to on Twitter about news stuff. I mostly use it just to kind of announce business things and have some debates about business stuff. I'm not on Facebook. I'm on Instagram a little bit, but I just deleted all my stuff. I don't want to support Facebook in general.
Oh, you did? You deleted your Facebook account?
I haven't had a Facebook account for a decade. And but on Instagram, I just got rid of all my stuff. All my pictures, I deleted them all. I still have my account currently, but I've deleted everything. So I'm in the process of ridding myself.
Uncoupling?
Yeah, of uncoupling. All right. I just found that, like, you know, the pace at which information is coming at you is unnecessary. If I read the newspaper, actually the physical newspaper, I found to be a much better news source than anything
it's
else.
It's really interesting.
You say one that. Time a day is enough. Yeah. Like, it's summarizing what happened yesterday that really matters versus like every 15 minutes reacting to what Trump said. Like, what's the point of that? Like, how is that? First of all, it's not healthy. Second of all, like, there's nothing happening every 15 minutes that really matters, like really, truly matters. I'd rather get a summary once a day or check in once a week or not check in at all and just hear about things occasionally. And like, the world goes on and I'm informed enough. And I might not be able to get into a deep argument or a discussion about a certain policy that's in the news right this moment, but I don't need to either. I don't care to. I don't want to.
But are you neglecting your responsibilities as a citizen by not?
What does that mean? What are my responsibilities as a citizen? Just pay attention to CNN and CNBC and MSNBC and every 15 minutes to see what the latest bullshit breaking news is. Like, everything is breaking now. Everything is breaking news. Like, so is it my
I have a theory that the breaking news chiron at CNN is broken.
They didn't
know how to turn it off, so they just leave it up there now.
Yeah, could be. But everything's breaking news. Everything's urgent. I mean, of course it's not. And so am I shirking my responsibility? I don't know what my responsibility is. If it's to be informed every 15 minutes, like, that's not actually my responsibility.
Do you...
My responsibility is to take care of myself and my family and my employees and my customers. Like, that's really my responsibility. And also to be, like, civically engaged to a certain degree where I have a sense of what's happening. But, look, whatever's happening right now, you and I are missing it because we're talking for an hour. Are we shirking our responsibility? Or like right when this is over, are you going to go to your phone and go, what did I miss over the last hour? I guarantee you nothing important.
Yes. No, I've cut down on my news consumption dramatically, partially because I've just had too much work to do, like 80 hours a week worth. But what's so interesting is like this last weekend, I wasn't on Twitter or any of that stuff and I wasn't checking the news. I was mostly hanging out with my kids and then working when I had time and reading a couple of books. And I think it was like Sunday evening or Monday or whatever it was. I was like, let me just see what's going on. And I open up Twitter on my computer because I don't have it on my phone anymore. And everyone's tweeting about Stephen Miller. And I'm like, what happened? Mm-hmm. Did he quit? Did Stephen Miller get fired?
Right.
And then I'm like, I've got to find out. I have to find out. And then I find out that they're tweeting about Stephen Miller's hair.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what happened to his hair? Did his hair catch on fire? And then I finally find that he like used spray on hair or something. It took me like 20 minutes to figure all this out. And then I was like, that's what I was just spent 20 minutes looking for. And then I closed my computer and was just like,
burned it.
Yeah.
It's this manic behavior. So like, these are the things that now represent your responsibility to stay on top of Stephen Miller's hair. Like, that's what people are doing now.
That's what people did on Sunday afternoon.
It's broken. It's broken. So it's actually an addiction, really, is what this is. It's an addiction. Because if you stay away, I don't know if you felt any sort of ping or pangs to go back, but you can. If you like turn your phone off for a day, and you'll feel like, shit, I need to do something with my hands now. I'm missing this whole routine. I think social media is going to be seen as the next cigarettes. I truly believe that in 20 years, we're going to look back and go, holy shit, was this bad for us? And these companies knew it. Because the thing is, if you think about like Philip Morris, what was worse, the bad part about that is they knew how addictive cigarettes were, and they didn't tell anybody. That was the really bad part about it. They knew the science, they knew how dangerous the shit was, and they kind of kept their mouths shut. I think that part of the reason you're seeing Apple do things like screen time and I don't know what Android's doing, but they have something similar, is because these companies recognize that this shit's bad for us and they want to make sure that they're in early with some responsible tools to get, so they could say like, we knew this and we're helping people deal with this addiction essentially. So if it's my responsibility to be addicted to Stephen Miller's hair, I'm happy to shirk that.
Okay, so this is really interesting. So we, in my family, not you know, my sister, a few friends too, we have a little thread going, a text thread, because we don't you know, use social media that much anymore. Mm-hmm. And where every week we share our screen time. And it's like a competition to see who uses their screen time less, even though I probably spend more time on my phone now looking at my screen time. And just yesterday we were doing it. And what's interesting thinking about it is, you know, Facebook would never, ever, ever do anything to try to stop you from using Facebook. But Apple can because you already own the phone. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't affect their business model to do that, right? So the question is there – I do agree with you that we're going to turn around in 20 years. I've been saying this for a long time now, that we'll turn around in 20 years and we'll realize that social media was like cigarettes, that people will not be using it the way they are today. And if it exists, it'll exist in a very different form. But let's just say that Jack Dorsey goes off to a 10-year silent retreat, right? And in Myanmar, and he says, "I want Jason to run my company." Is there a world in which you as CEO of Twitter, can actually have a service like social media that's good for the world that encourages you not to use it as much, or is that just a misnomer that?
Right. Well, I think it comes down back to business model again. Like, so like Facebook is encouraged, you know, they want engagement is what they're all after, all these guys, right? So, you know, they got to get you watching these things. Apple doesn't have to do that, of course, right? So there's that. First of all, I would never want to run any other business besides my own, but if I had to, you know, you want to start thinking about like, what are we trying to do here? Twitter is trying to grow. Everyone's trying to grow eternally. There's no like we're big enough or we're small enough or whatever. It's just like continued growth. And so I think that you have to break that pattern first. Otherwise, you're going to end up doing everything you can to encourage more users to sign up and to get more screen or more usage numbers and whatnot, because that's how the street looks at you and they look at daily active users and all this stuff. So you have to just break out of that and not do that anymore and maybe run a smaller company. Maybe start charging people for things. Maybe have a smaller base. I don't know. But as far as like, to me, social media simply just reflects what humans who humans are and what they want.
I don't agree with that.
Okay, let's talk about it.
So here's my theory, and sorry if people have heard me say this before, but my theory is that the people who built these platforms, Zuck, Dorsey, we can go through the whole list. Mm-hmm. They, for the most part, have social anxiety, you can say. Like, I don't know what the clinical term is for what Zuckerberg has, other than maybe he's a robot,
right?
But that someone built in a laboratory and escaped and started Facebook. Totally possible.
MIT. They're all out there. Yeah, they're in Boston. Yeah.
But these are clearly people, you've spent time with them, I've spent time with them. They have problems actually having conversations with other human beings. Mm-hmm. And I think that they built these technologies to help them diffuse that. And one of the problems that they have is they, as human beings, I don't believe Mark Zuckerberg has empathy for other people. I truly do not believe it as part of his DNA. Mm-hmm. And I think that as a result, empathy does not exist in social media, right? And so you now have people on Earth who are using these tools built by people who do not have this thing called empathy or a lot of it. And therefore, there's no ability to be able to – it's not built into the software. And so my theory is not that the software is a mirror of humans. I believe it's like one of those funny house mirrors where you kind of look a little oblong and weird.
Yeah. Because because there's a sense of anonymity, you mean?
Like, it's not the anonymity.
There's no consequences. I think that's part of
yes,
it.
Yes,
like,
that is it.
It's like these are private thoughts people have, I think.
Yeah.
And now they can say them out loud with no consequences. Like you wouldn't say some of these things to a person.
No.
Even if you like disagreed with them entirely, you wouldn't say these things to them, to their face in that way. But you can because it's indirect. I think that's what it is. This is indirect communication. It's being sent out. You're throwing something over the wall to somebody else. And you can't see how they receive it, and they can't see how you send it, but it's being sent and being received, but you don't really know who you're talking to. It's like you're talking through a wall. And I think that that's part of it too. I think that's why I think it reflects like a lot of people's internal thinking without the consequences of having to say it out loud to somebody. So I do think this is just simply, everyone has a microphone now, and everyone can talk and say what they think. And it's also like, there's this tribalness about it, I think, that really is really brought out in social media, where people gang up and talk about things.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a very human thing. tribalism is an incredibly human thing. I mean, but you find your tribe and you double down with them.
But you wouldn't, you know, if your neighbor did something that you didn't like, you wouldn't get all the other neighbors to go to their house and throw rocks through their window.
No.
You would be like, oh, that guy's a douchebag.
Because because it's direct.
Yes.
And there's consequences in society. So if you're an asshole to your neighbor, that's going to pay off poorly for you some other time down the road. So you do something, I mean, hopefully you do something nice because you're a nice person. But if you get strategic about it, you're like, I want to help my neighbor because they or maybe want to help me, or I'm going to need their help down the road. You reciprocate. In social media, there's such a distance and an abstract nature to it that you don't think about that part of it. So you can just bitch at someone if you want and disagree with someone because who cares?
So is your theory that in 20 years, 30 years, 10 years, whatever it is, that it won't exist or it will exist differently? Or what do you think will happen? And look, we're guessing the future.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that people will see it to be unhealthy. I think people will see the constant need to react and respond to things to be unnatural and unhealthy. I think that's what they'll see. I think people are going to, of course, talk through technology. Like, that's not going to go away. And people are going to share moments in their lives and whatever. You might see more private accounts and smaller groups forming again. You know, like I just saw Instagram release this thing where you can do stories now only with your close friends. So you mark someone as a close friend versus sharing with everybody. So I think there's this turn back towards who's really in your circle, like who are your people really versus like everybody who follows you. The other thing is that I find really, really weird is that in social media, especially Twitter, and I don't know how Facebook works anymore. Do you have to accept somebody if they want to follow you?
Well, people can follow you if you're public even think you have to be public. I think they can follow you if you allow them to, if you create an account where you allow people to follow. And then anything you post public is public. But then if you want someone to engage with you, you have to accept
that. Here's the big problem with Twitter, I think, which is that if you @mention me, you can get a piece of my attention instantly.
Yes.
That's fucking fucked up.
Yeah.
That's bad. That's mm-hmm. unhealthy and terrible.
And that's intentional.
It is intentional, although I don't really know if it's it's intentional. Like, that's the way the software works. But I don't know if they drew it out to its conclusion, which is today... Like, if you want to yell at someone, you can yell at them and they have to listen to you. That's just really weird. I think that's unhealthy. So I think some of that behavior is going to change. But I'm actually more curious about, like, are our brains built to handle 100 dopamine hits a day? I would imagine not. I'm curious to see, like, over the long term, what that actually does to us.
Well, my theory is, and I question is whether this will parlay into normal society, people not like us that are not obsessed with tech and all these things. But like, my theory is that you can't beat the computer. So don't play.
Yeah.
You can't beat the algorithm. And so for me, that's why, I mean, I've said this before, but every single human being I know personally, from my neighbors, kids, teenage kids, to my wife, my sister, you name it, have all been deleting apps from their phone. Sometimes they reinstall them because they lose the game, but they've been deleting apps from their phone and not using these things as much because they fill their lives. Like, when we did that, we did a screen time competition with my sister, and she was on Instagram 8.5 hours a week.
Oh, shit.
You know how long that is? If it were a 9-to-5 job, that'd be a month and a half of her life every year.
Yeah.
Like, that's insane.
It is. It's really bad.
And so what choice do you have if you're losing but to walk away? And I guess the question is do you think that it's going to move beyond just people like us to the people who don't think about the technological implications?
Well, I think it depends, right? Which is how often or how many hours are people spending on this stuff? If you just jump in every once in a while, like, maybe it's no big deal. But if people like us in our world who are on it all the time, they're going to be the first ones to leave, I think, because they're going to be burned out. It's burnout, basically. Yeah. People are experiencing burnout. So I think... But you can burn out, and then you can take time off. You can come back. I don't know. I don't know what it's going to look like. I do think that what should change is that the receiver of so if I log into Twitter, you should not be able to yell at me. Like, I should.
I'm sorry that I yelled at you.
You should not be able to get a piece of my attention.
No, I completely agree. I completely agree.
That's broken. That's just, and so that's going to change. I think it has to.
Well, I don't think anything's changing at Twitter, but yes.
True. You're probably right, but. You're probably right about that. But I think, like, conceptually, I think that's the kind of stuff people are going to probably want to get more control over who can reach them. I think the circles are going to get smaller. But look, frankly, most people don't have, I mean, like, you have a lot of followers. I have a lot of followers on Twitter. Most people don't have that. They've got 50, 100, and then it's not a problem for them.
Yeah.
You know, you're a public figure, so people can bitch at you about your points of view or whatever. Most people don't, no one's yelling at them. No one's talking to them. Like, no one's hearing
them. I'm happy to yell at anyone. Just hit me up on Twitter and I'll respond and yell at you.
But I think I don't know, there's a lot of brokenness. And I think the thing for me that really bugs me, and one of the reasons I'm getting off Instagram, I got rid of my stuff, but I'm not gone completely yet, which is interesting, is how it makes me feel about the things I do. So I collect vintage watches. It's something I've done for many years. And being on Instagram has accelerated my collecting. And I find myself buying things because I want to show other people what I have. And that really fucked me up when I realized that that's why I was doing certain things. And that really bugged me because it felt like I was not being true to myself. I was now doing things for others, which is what I think social media often is. You're doing things for others. Yep. You're putting on airs. So that's the reason I'm moving off Instagram, is because I don't want to do things for other people. I want to make sure if I buy something, I buy something because I want it, not because I want a reaction from somebody else telling me, great job, great buy, great find, whatever. If you're doing things for other people, I think you can be nice to other people, but if you're
trying to show the thing that you have so that you, for other people to gratify it, it's wrong.
Yes.
Which is why I stopped using Instagram a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it's smart.
I just realized that it wasn't the things I was buying, but it was the things I was doing. And I just realized, why do I need people to see that I'm doing this? I don't.
Like, you don't.
If I'm enjoying it, I'm enjoying it. Yeah. You can take a picture of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's really interesting. So one of the questions I have for you is this question I struggle with a lot is, you know, Kevin Kelly was on here last year and he was talking, we were talking about how he believes that technology makes society better. Even if it's 51% and worse 49%, it's still the arc of better is still moving in a positive direction, right? And the question I have is, when you look at all the technologies that we use today, there are technologies around, you know, healthcare and car safety and all these things that are actually there. You cannot argue for ways in which they make the world worse. They predominantly make the world better. I mean, sure, if you put in airbags and seatbelts and ABS brakes, people are going to drive faster and then accidents could be worse. But for the most part, they're saving lives. The same with, you know, medical equipment and so on. When you look at all of these technologies, like Twitter, for example, the question I have is, if it wasn't for those things, there would be no Me Too movement in the way it exists. There would be no Black Lives Matter movement, so on and so forth. But at the same time, there probably wouldn't be a Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And do you think that is there a world where we kind of this plays out differently, where we slow down with the technology we built, where we, I don't know, is it better that we're building it? Is it worse?
Well, movements have happened all through history without these things. Important movements. So, like, people do gather, and in fact, frankly, like, protest has become so easy today that I don't think it's actually as effective.
Yeah, it doesn't do anything.
You know, in some cases it is, of course, but like,
but we marching didn't need in these the things. Street doesn't do what marching in the street used to do.
Right, because there's a lot of marches in the streets now. And so I think, like, you know, anyway, I think that movements have always happened. History's changed many, 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 many times without this shit, without social media. So I don't think it's necessary to have change without it. I think it might accelerate change, but what else does it accelerate? Like, there's costs, there's side effects to all this stuff. And so I think it's actually probably damaging more people than it's helping, for sure. And so you wouldn't say that necessarily about a new medication that comes out that saves someone's life or airbags or whatever. So I think it's a net negative. I think that social media is a net negative. I do.
Do you think other technologies are net negative?
Well, that's a broad question. Like, yeah. I mean, if you really want to go into it, I think like anything that in like, well, yeah, I guess most really, if you look at like the whole system, like the world, humans are destroying it, and it's because of technology. Like, really, ultimately, I mean, like, you know, pollution, growth, you know, pesticides, all this stuff we're doing. It's like it makes it better for us, kind of, maybe, sort of, but maybe not in the long term, but it makes it worse for every other species on the planet. I know we're getting very broad here, but so, I mean, like, humans are the worst thing that ever happened to the planet Earth, obviously.
Do you think that humans will lead to the end of humans?
Yes. I do eventually somehow. But I don't think, like, I don't think, I just think that humans are basically like a virus. A virus lives off its host for a while.
Yeah.
And it thinks it's going to live forever off its host. And then it realizes it fucking goes too far and kills its host. And then it's over. The thing is, like, the Earth will be here long after we're gone. And animals will be here long after we're gone. And plants will be here long after we're gone. Even if we fucking kill the planet as we're doing now, like, in 100 million years, like, on the time scale of the planet doesn't care about us. We'll go away. Shit will get bad for a while and it'll get better and everything will be fine. But, like, this is something I've been thinking a lot about lately, which is we are not intelligent. We think we're intelligent beings. We are not intelligent.
Go on.
Right?
You've got me here. Keep going.
How can we be intelligent if all we do is destroy everything else? Is that intelligence? Destroying everything else? Is that an intelligent move? Like, if you think about, you know, like, humans are intelligent and all other forms of animals are just, you know, whatever, animals, right? Well, they've figured out how to live together. They figured out how to exist together. They have they don't take more than they need. Like, that's actually pretty smart, isn't it? Versus our intelligence, which is to destroy everything and to destroy ourselves and make our water dangerous to drink, our air dangerous to breathe. You know, all the things we're doing, which are killing everything, basically. We're reducing biodiversity. All these things we're doing, these are not intelligent moves.
But is that a bug in our system, do you think, maybe? Or is it just the way we're designed?
I don't know.
But I think the thing that I find that I spend a lot of time thinking about is technology, how it relates to humanity. So without technology, we would not be sitting here having this conversation that people not sitting here are listening to somewhere else. And we would be living in caves and we would be, you know, just animals, right? And it is, people talk about how art is the thing that separates us from animals. I actually believe it's technology. I'm sure there are birds that make beautiful art, right? And I think that it is technology that separates us, and it is, but at the same time, it is technology that is leading to our own destruction. And I just wonder if there's a world where we at some point ever get to this realization, and can we ever even stop building technology?
No.
So therefore, we are designed.
We're a virus.
To destruct.
Well, we're a virus. Like, that's what a virus does. Infects its host, and then it eventually kills it. Or, I mean, sometimes the host fights back and beats the virus, but, like, a lot of things, they just kind of, you know, they go and they go and they go until they kill whatever the host is, and then they die too. Like, we're not going to stop this. We're not going to stop this. And the whole thing I always hear about, like, well, we have until 2024 until, like, it's the point of no return. It's already past the point of no return. It's probably past the point of no return in the 80s, in the 70s, in the 60s. The Industrial Revolution was probably the point of no return.
How do you feel when you people talk about AI and job loss and what's going to happen in the next X number of years?
I have so many different thoughts about it. I'm not that up on it really to know really, but I think the algorithm is overrated, actually.
In what way?
I think that we think that things are going to be intelligent very quickly, and that it's going to be—it's going to take over the world fast. I'm on the side of Elon Musk and I think Stephen Hawking and whoever else was like, this is actually quite dangerous. I just don't think there's any way to deal with it. But I also don't think that, for example, let me just give you a quick example that's more concrete. A few years ago, people were thinking like automated cars are right around the corner. I don't think that that's true at all. I think like we have a Tesla, and that autopilot is fucking dangerous, and it's very, 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 very far away from actually truly being trustworthy, completely, thoroughly trustworthy, which is what you would expect an intelligent creature or being or something to be. And I, in fact, think that it's highly reckless for them to call it autopilot. First of all, that's another problem.
That's Elon Musk just being Elon Musk, right?
Right. But anyway. It's not as close as we think, I don't think, But I do think that that there's a lot of jobs that will be replaced by computers, and there always have been, and then new jobs come up. But I'm not optimistic on removing humanity from decision making, because I think that decisions about people should be made by people, and I'm wary about taking people out of the role of thinking about humanity and putting that in charge of machines. I don't think that that's really going to be healthy or good for humanity.
But yeah, but again, back to our virus analogy here, like we tend to do things that we don't think are good for humanity, right?
We don't, but like here's the other thing. There's only one, let's get back to the intelligence thing. There's only one intelligent life form, let's call it intelligence, that at our level on Earth. And that's all we would allow to happen. If dolphins all of a sudden became really fucking smart, we would kill them all, right? Like we would. We don't want a threat. And so if there's AI that's really, 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 really smart beyond our means, they're going to look at us like we look at a dolphin or we look at a bird and go, well, you don't need you either. And so like, they're not going to make good decisions about our well-being. Why would they? Why should they? What's in it for them? And them, we're, you know, calling AI them, but like, what's in it for them to take care of us? I think it's like, that's where humanity is missing the point. Like we're creating this thing, maybe not missing the point, but we're creating this thing that we think is going to take care of us and work with us. Why would it? Who do we work with? We're the most intelligent beings on this planet. Who do we work with? What animals do we work with besides dogs?
Dogs.
Yeah, dogs.
Yeah.
Because they're non-threatening.
Cats.
Dogs got smart and cats got really smart, like really smart. They would not be our best friends. So like, I just don't see two intelligent
things. I think dogs
things.
Are actually really smart in that they're like, I don't really feel like doing anything. So if I'm just nice to this person, they'll feed me food. And that's maybe it. So maybe they are smarter than us.
They are. Yeah, they are. Cats are too. Cats are very manipulative in that way, right? Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like there's not room for two highly intelligent life forms or existent. I don't know if you'd call AI life. You probably wouldn't, but whatever.
Eventually
you know.
It will be.
Yeah. And like, it's going to do away with us. What does it need us for?
It's true.
So I don't think that part, I don't know when that happens, but that part scares me. Like I've got two kids, young kids, your age kids. Yeah. And like, that's scary.
It's terrifying.
But like, I think about what it was like in the 60s and what it was like in the 20s and what it was like during World War I and World War II. Like, there's been a lot of really scary moments where like the future is fucked over.
Well, there's
but I feel like we had a sense of, we knew humans were in control of that destiny, even if they were humans we didn't like. And I think you can think there's a reason there. There's a chance to like pull things back. I think if AI gets ahead of us or whatever, and it's like, you can't pull that back unless you can unplug it from the wall. Like you can't pull that back.
Well, it's interesting. There's this guy, Nick Bostrom, who writes about AI and he runs an institute at Oxford University. And he just put out a paper talking about how every technology, if you think about technology as an urn, and it's every technology is a ball we pull out of the urn. And most technologies are white balls. They're like predominantly good. A lot of them are gray, where they could be used for good or for bad. But we eventually get to the point where they don't destroy humanity. For example, nuclear power was also nuclear war. And then as a result of the Cold War, there was a standoff where we didn't actually use it because we knew the people in charge knew, oh, well, this isn't going to work out. But what he's saying essentially is that eventually we will pull out a black ball from that urn and there may not be no turning back from that. And it's, you know, it's funny, like I keep stressing this about the technology and the good and the bad and what's coming. And I just believe that that's what will be the demise of us. And eventually someone will pull a black urn out and a black ball out of the urn. And like when I think about my kids and their kids and when that could happen,
yeah,
it's pretty terrifying.
Well, so what do you think is going to happen then?
Over,
let's call it 20 years, which is, you know, the number everyone picks when it's like kind of far away, but not that far away.
I think over the next...
Is it going to be that different, really?
I don't think over the next 20 years it's going to be that different. I do think that we'll start to see driverless cars. I think what's going to happen with driverless cars is that the technology is not ready. I think it's incredibly irresponsible of Elon Musk to put it out there. That being said, when you look at the number of hours of human drivers in an accident and the number of hours of autopilot code in an accident, human drivers, I think it's like every 90,000 hours on a road, there's a fatal accident. With autopilot, it's like so far it's been like every several hundred thousand. So it's still better than us dumb humans.
Sure.
But I think that what will happen is eventually the technology will be ready and you will one day wake up and there won't just be one driverless car on the road. They'll all be driverless. Or most of them will be. And I think that that's going to happen with a lot of technologies where you're not going to see it happen in a vacuum. You'll see driverless cars, and then drones delivering, because the same code and the same chips and the same AI that exists to make the car driverless is going to be the same thing that exists to make the drones delivery, and so on and so forth. And I think that what you'll see happen is all of that will happen pretty simultaneously, pretty quickly. But the results are going to be both incredible and terrifying. You know, they'll be incredible because no one will ever die in a car accident again, but they'll be terrifying because 10.5 million truckers will leave their job overnight.
Yeah.
And so I've been covering tech companies for 15 years now, and it's taken me 15 years to learn that with each time something comes along, it looks amazing, and then something really bad happens with it. And we saw that with Trump and democracy and Russia, and with something as mundane as social media. And I think that when we look at these future technologies, all we should be talking about is what bad is going to happen, rather than like, oh, it's going to be really cool and you can watch porn in your car as you're driving to work, right, or whatever it is.
So I agree with all of that. What do you think, though, about like things like Amazon? Amazon as a technology, meaning like I can buy something and have it in an hour, or have it in, you know, 2 days for free, or the next day for $4, and the Amazon Prime as a technology. Like, do you think that that's a net positive?
I don't know. I think it is. I use Amazon religiously.
I've stopped shopping there.
Have
just
you?
Just recently. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Because?
I don't like, to me, the HQ2 thing was like the final blow for me. Like, what the fuck was that about?
Yeah.
And I don't, in full disclosure, like Jeff Bezos owns a small piece of Basecamp. So I'm just.
Not anymore. He just sold it on eBay.
Yeah. Anyway, like. So, like, I'm just speaking truly for myself here. I don't like the way that happened.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is symptomatic of what's gone wrong in capitalism on a variety of different levels, and government too. And I've realized, like, I don't need to buy things and have them the next day. So I'm now going to manufacturers' websites and buying things, and shipping's typically slower. I'm going to a store and actually getting it quickly if I need it.
Go to the store.
I actually go to the store. I've been going to Best Buy a lot more now for electronics stuff, and it's like
still in business?
I'm actually but it's funny because it's nice. Like, I need something, I'll go over there and get it, and like I get it and I take it home and I have it. And like, versus you know, because like you buy stuff at Amazon, now you have a cardboard maintenance problem. You know, you get boxes everywhere.
Well, I think it's the larger problem is it goes back to that conversation at the beginning, is that like, why does something need to be that big? I don't think that it should be. I don't think anything should be.
I agree.
And
we also saw this with our book, for example. Our book, over 90% of the sales are at Amazon.
Huh.
That's fucking broken. That's just, I don't have a solution for that problem. It's not like more bookstores would make it easier. But the fact is that 90%, they basically dominate 90% of the business book market. And that just seems wrong to me. Or like, and I get what it's easy, and they've made it great. It's an interesting thing because they've made the experience great. It's not like Amazon's a bad experience and they're forcing you to shop there or anything like that. It's not like that at all. But at some point, I've chosen, like, we're not going to buy stuff from Amazon for a while. Buy something from other stores and spread money around that way. And like, you know, the other thing I've realized is that with Apple Pay specifically, checkout has become a lot easier, and Shopify and Apple Pay too, both of those have made shopping at most stores really, really damn good, just as easy as Amazon, basically. And I'm finding it's like, I'd rather give all the money to the store or to the manufacturer than have them, you know, lose 30% or whatever they have to do wholesale to get their products in Amazon. I'd rather just give them the money. I think it's better.
I think maybe I'll try that for a couple of hours.
It's a good start. But really, like, you don't need to shop at Amazon. Like,
no, I know.
All these things we feel like
we
need now.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's more of a, for me, it's more of an experiment. Like, for a month or so, we're not
going
to shop at Amazon. Like, the world continues to move forward and everything's fine.
Well, it's funny because I shop at Whole Foods, and they always encourage you, do you have the Whole Foods app, the Amazon Whole Foods app? And you pull it out and you scan it under the thing at the register, and you're supposed to, like, it's supposed to save money. But like 90% of the time, you don't save anything. It's just them tracking you.
It's a habit. They're creating habits.
Yes.
And they're creating an addiction. It's another addiction. These companies are addictive companies.
Yes.
And they didn't start that way. I'm not saying like they had this mindset to set, but they've become that. And I think that, I mean, addiction in any way is a dangerous thing, especially when it's institutionalized and it's affecting millions of people.
Billions.
Billions of people are addicted to social media. Millions of people are addicted to Amazon. Addicted to it, literally. Yeah. You go, without Amazon, I wouldn't have anything. No, you'd have everything you need, you'd still have.
Yeah.
Promise you.
We should try this. Maybe it'll be our New Year's resolution and see how it works out.
Yeah.
All right, last question for you before we let you go. If you had to give someone their 2019 New Year's resolution about making them less stressed about work and, you know, the way that they are totally consumed by it, if you had to give them one piece of advice, what would it be? One piece to like their New Year's resolution. I am not going to do X or I am going to do Y. What is it?
I think the one thing I would say is the next time you feel like you have to say yes to something, say no to it instead and just see what happens. So this happens a lot, for example, with I hear about it with client services firms, like a design firm. Their client will email them at 11 o'clock. People say like, well, Jason, like, you know, what if my client emails me at 10 o'clock? I'm like, well, then you fucking get back to them tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. They're like, well, they email me at 10. I have to get back to them. No, you don't. You set, the moment you set that expectation and you see it through and you set the tone, they will continue to demand that from you. But you can just say no and get back to them tomorrow morning and they're not going to fire you and everything's going to be fine. So I think that next moment you're like, I have to do this, say no, I'm not going to do that.
All right. So you heard Jason, and if it doesn't work out, Jason, and you get fired,
blame
Jason
me.
We'll hire you.
We actually have a hiring freeze, so we're not hiring.
Okay. So then if it doesn't work out, I'm sorry. And thanks for listening.
Yeah.
Jason, thanks so much. The book is It Doesn't Have to Be Crazy at Work. It's a great read. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Nick. It was really fun.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
So I have someone I'm going to briefly bring on the show, Krista.
Hi, everyone.
That's my wife. And a couple of weeks ago, we signed up for The New Yorker in print, and it has changed our life, right?
It's been amazing.
So one of the great things about The New Yorker is it is one of the best magazines in America today. They publish some of the world's best writers, most rigorous reporting, and most compelling storytelling. Now that we get it delivered every week and you read it online and whatnot, what are some of the favorite things that you love about it, Krista?
Well, first of all, I just love getting it in the mail. It is so much fun to open it up in the midst of the bills and all the other stuff. But I love reading about their news, their politics, international affairs, climate change and the environment, pop culture and the arts, science and technology, poetry, food, humor. I love the cartoons, you name it. It's great.
I love the cartoons too. That's my favorite part. No offense to the writing. The writing is amazing. They are really incredible.
Well, you got to mention the tote bag.
Well, we'll get to the tote bag in 1 second. one of the things that's great about the writing is they do these long form pieces, which I always love finding in the magazine and online about things that you didn't even know you would be so fascinated by, like paper jams and fault lines and heirloom beans and stink bugs.
Wow.
Of all things. They have home delivery of the print section every week, which we now get. You can see stories published online every day, 15 to 20 news articles. I've been following along with all of the coverage of Trump this week and Mattis and God knows what else. Should we talk about the tote bag?
The tote bag is great. Nick walks around with his tote bag.
I love my tote bag. So
our three-year-old loves it too.
So don't wait. If you go to newyorker.com/hive, listeners of this podcast will save 50% when they enter the code HIVE.
That's 50%? That's huge.
How do you spell HIVE, Krista?
HIVE.
That's right. With this special offer, you'll receive 12 issues for just $6 plus... you get an exclusive New Yorker
tote bag.
I love my tote bag. So go on right now. Check it out. NewYorker.com/hive.
It's a great deal. Really.
It's a great deal for absolutely no money at all. Welcome back to Inside the Hive. I'm here with John Kelly, who is just days away from being pushed out of the White House. John, before we jump into the news, I just have one question for you. Are you okay with me completely ignoring your emails, Slack notifications, text messages, faxes, and other forms of communication?
No, I'm not okay with that.
Okay, that's a deal. I'm going to start doing that from here on out.
No, I'm not okay with that. I think you misheard me. I'm not okay with that.
Okay, well, maybe I could like delay responding a little bit, you know, like...
It's funny. That is one of those real millennial things that, you know, it's good for the culture in some ways where they're sort of dictating the parameters of working hours, but it's also so annoying too that some people feel it's totally unacceptable to email before 8 o'clock or after 7 or whenever, you know, the world is constantly ablaze, and we're just trying to keep up. So anyway, I have my personal thoughts. That's why I'm not a massively wealthy tech CEO.
Or an author, or anything else for that matter. So
I'm nothing. No, I'm nothing.
So speaking of nothing, let's just talk about Facebook real quick. So I am kind of shocked that this is all still going on, that that every single solitary week this year there has been some sort of crazy Facebook story that's come out. Somebody at BuzzFeed this week did a pretty amazing roundup of all of the times that Facebook was in the news this year, and it's an article that seems to scroll to infinity. It's been just one after the other after the other. And what is so astounding to me is that the board of directors and the U.S. government has done nothing to change anything.
Yeah, and they're not going to anytime soon, right? I mean, I feel like the Sundar Pichai's recent hearing in Congress was meaningful in how it evidenced how little lawmakers understand about these large tech platforms. I mean, I think that there were a number of politicians asking about why their iPhone wouldn't work, and he sort of had to politely deflect and say that he worked at Google, that he ran Google. So it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to see how regulation happens, and it'll be interesting if a persuasive, charismatic politician like Beto O'Rourke comes in and tries to make that case, because Silicon Valley has traditionally been an ally to the Democratic Party in terms of fundraising and in terms of facilitating the message. I do agree with the story that you wrote this week, Nick, a very good story about how regulation is coming, but I think that it's coming far enough away that these platforms have time to either self-correct or obfuscate and dodge. The board the board is just a grosser thing, right? I mean, the board is doing what the stock market is doing. It's recognizing that in Zuckerberg and Sandberg, they have this like dynamic, dynastic, all-time leadership team. And they've more or less grown every quarter for a decade, and they're willing to take all kinds of reputational hits under the belief that they'll take the money.
I think that at the end of the day, this is a company that has not changed its stripes in over a decade. I do think there was a moment where Zuckerberg kind of seemed like he was growing up, and maybe that was just he was learning how to, you know, he was taking acting classes and doing a better job at acting like he was growing up. But I think that, you know, it's just downhill from here at this point out. And what I find so amazing is just the fact that this company, it's just one after the other after the other, and the fact and how untruthful they are and the lack of consequences. One of the things that was so amazing this week was the Senate report that came out that said, you know, Mark Zuckerberg had come up before Congress and talked about all the things they'd found on Facebook related to the Russian meddling in the election. And he didn't mention all the things that they found on Instagram. And the Senate, in their investigation, found that it was double the number of interactions on Instagram with Russian-related posts than it had been on Facebook. And this is, I mean, come clean. Tell us what happened. Like, you know, say we screwed up royally, and here's everything. Don't just say we kind of screwed up, and here's a couple of things.
But I think that one of the issues, though, Nick, is that there's no coming clean. Like, the company is built on these kind of data relationships, and as Tim Cook said, you know, certainly in his own self-interest, but poignantly, Facebook, their product is your data, you know.
Yeah,
that's their fundamental product, is taking your data and distributing it in one form or other to advertisers that want to pay to align against it, and there's no way that you can't get out in front of that, because you're always going to find new and embarrassing relationships, business relationships that you have, and new anecdotes about, you know, terrifying moments in the culture that Facebook played a part in. I think it's an inescapable thing.
I think that, you know, just to wrap up the Facebook saga of 2018, there's the amazing quote that from the internal message that Bosworth, Boz as they call him, an exec at Facebook sent, that leaked earlier this year, where it said, He said, maybe someone dies in a terrorist attack coordinated on our tools and still we connect people. The fact that that is a company that's okay with that speaks volumes. So my theory is that at the end of, if we have this conversation a year from now, I think the user growth will have slowed. I think that the advertising revenue will not, it'll still be there in the billions, but it won't be growing in the way that it has. And I think that, I think you're really going to start to see a huge backlash away from Facebook. Does that mean, you know, people go to Instagram and WhatsApp that the company owns? That I don't know, but I think that Facebook, the product, has seen its best years. But that's just my prediction. Who knows?
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
All right, listen up, listeners. I am about to give you some free money, legitimate free money. And the way I'm going to do that is the way that I did it, with an app called Robinhood, which is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, crypto, all commission-free. If you are not in this world already, don't worry, because it is so simple to use Robinhood. They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy. The app is, without question, one of the most beautiful apps on my phone. It's clear, beautiful data presentation. It's so intuitive. Not only does Robinhood give you cost-free, no commission fees, you can make trades from as little as $10 to as big as however much you want, but they also allow you to look at stocks in collections, which is one of my favorite features. They have the 100 most popular stocks. They have entertainment, social media. I wouldn't invest in those right now. They have female CEOs. They tell you with their analysts whether you should buy, hold, sell. They can teach you how to invest, how to build your portfolio. And the best part, well, under than a beautiful looking app, but the best part is Robinhood is giving listeners of Inside the Hive a free stock, like an Apple stock, a Ford stock, or a Sprint stock, to help you build your portfolio. All you need to do is sign up at Bilton, B-I-L-T-O-N, .robinhood.com. That's Bilton, B-I-L-T-O-N, .robinhood.com. That's my last name. And you will get a free stock when you sign up. You have to do it. I did it. I'm building my portfolio slowly, and Robinhood is helping me do it. It's a really, really great opportunity. Bilton.robinhood.com.
Well, I'll just leave you with this one thought. It's frustrating that there's a sort of like computer science engineer lack of humanity education mindset that is pervasive in Silicon Valley and in the tech sector in particular. And when you read statements like the Boz one that you're quoting, that's where you see that, you know, that they're solving, you know, picture the air quotes. I hate that phrase. They're solving for, you know, larger societal issues, and they're sort of acknowledging that, yeah, okay, maybe along the way there are going to be some major mistakes and mishaps, and for a culture and for a business that is so exact in its precision of what it's trying to correct, you'd think that they'd be able to avoid those missteps if they were slightly less avaricious. It really is as simple as that. But I do wonder, like, in what does a Facebook Me Too movement look like? Because I do think you're right and you're onto something, that it's possible that in the same way that it took years and years and years for the bow to break against men in particular who would behave terribly and abuse power dynamics, there will be some sort of bow breaking with Facebook.
Yeah,
and it'll have its own cultural moment where it absorbs the shock of something with the consequences of Me Too in this country. I don't know if it's going to happen.
Oh, I think it'll happen
in Europe too.
I think it'll happen in
but
Europe.
I don't think it'll happen in Africa or Asia. I think that it's a different product in South America, Africa, and to the extent it exists in Asia.
I think it'll happen in Europe before it happens here. But I do think you're right. I think that the delete Facebook hashtag is not it. I think it's in the same way there was a Me Too movement, there'll probably be a not me movement where people are like, I am not going to let this product be a part of my life. I'm not going to let them track me and deliver ads to me. The hope I have is that the best case scenario for me is Facebook gets broken up. That there's Facebook, mm-hmm. there's Instagram, there's WhatsApp. They're run by different people, and that is the only way Mark Zuckerberg learns how much he fucked everything up. Other than that, it's regulation as far as like what people can, what they labels they have to put on, things like that are negligible. I think that the company needs to be broken up. So there's that. All right, moving on to bigger, brighter, and more orange things. It's been a pretty rough week for Donald Trump, huh? At the White House. I mean, you've got your revolving door. You've got him making a fool out of himself in ways that he hasn't done in hours. And now you've got Mattis resigning. So can you tell me, because I don't get it. I don't understand what's going on. I haven't been looking at the news for about 4 or 5 minutes. Can you tell me what this whole Mattis thing means? I know Mattis and Trump actually have a really good relationship. So what's actually going on here?
Well, no one can definitively say precisely what's going on here, but it seems like there are a number of related data points. You know, Trump sort of conceded on the wall recently, and now it seems like he's potentially willing to hold the government hostage over his wall as Christmas arrives, and he appears to be bracing for a ugly 2019, one in which indictments seem to be forthcoming, one in which a Democratic-led Congress is pretty much swearing to make his life hell. It's possible his taxes will be released. Trump is trying to make some last minute campaign promises to stir up his base. I think that his redoubled insistence on the wall is one of them. I think that the withdrawal of troops from Syria is another. It seems like that's an incident that played a significant role, maybe even antecedent in Mattis's resignation. And then the thing that's scary right now, I mean, this will be dated by the time people are listening to this, but I'm just like hitting refresh on my computer. CNN's reporting that aides are terrified that Trump is going to pull out of Afghanistan, which, if true, we would be surrendering our forces in not just a very crucial part of the Middle East, or I guess an area also where Russia has an engagement, but also in like a core of the larger American defense strategy. And withdrawing from Afghanistan, I'm not a geopolitical scholar, but it opens up all kinds of really terrifying questions about Pakistan, Iran. It seems that Trump is trying to check boxes and being absolutely foolhardy. And this is terrifying. I mean, this is terrifying. Hopefully somebody gets to him, or as Bob Woodward noted in Fear, that there's some sort of Gary Cohn figure who just like gets the memo off his desk before he signs it.
Yeah, what's so fascinating is I just was reading Mattis's letter of resignation. There's not a word of Trump in there, so maybe that once solid relationship is no longer. But essentially, it seems that what it's come down to is that Mattis is saying that he is more aligned with our allies than he is with our own president, and he can't do it anymore.
Well, I think he just doesn't want. I think he just doesn't want any potential blood in his hands. The administration is going to have more staff defections, and it's going to have a very hard time replacing people. Our colleague Gabe Sherman had a fantastic detail in a story reported this week that the reason why they're calling Mick Mulvaney acting chief of staff is because there's some fear that, like, you know, what if he and Trump have a falling out soon? I mean, Mulvaney, as we now know, called the guy basically a disgrace during the campaign. So the people closest to Trump realize that the small circle is getting even smaller, and excuse me, he has a lot of appointments to make, and they are crucial appointments. And then we're led to believe that he's going to spend the next 16 days playing golf and just fucking around in his dining room in Mar-a-Lago.
I think the most exciting part of all this, though, is what is it? How many days? I don't know, like 2 weeks before we get the new house, and then
a little more than that, yeah.
But a couple weeks, whatever, 2-3 weeks. But it's, I think that's when we're really going to start to kind of see some changes happen. I don't know. Maybe I'm being naive in saying that and hoping that the government will actually do something.
Well, no, I think you're right. I think Elijah Cummings and Adam Schiff, you know, who oversee really important ethics and investigative committees, are you know, champing at the bit to roll out a red carpet of investigations. And you know, one sort of plot line that I'm following very closely is the effort to get Trump's taxes, you know, which are, you know, I think a Senate Oversight Committee could petition or potentially subpoena. I'm not a legal scholar or jurisprudential scholar, but they could subpoena the IRS, which falls underneath Mnuchin, and they'd have to view them privately. Things in Washington always seem to leak. Mnuchin might be in a position where he has to push back. I part of me, this is just the conspiracy theorist to me, wonders if one reason why Mnuchin wasn't moved into the chief of staff job was because being at Treasury right now is a very valuable asset. Having a real ally sycophant to Treasury is a major asset for Trump, who certainly, I presume, wants to keep those IRS documents confidential, since it seems that the long search for any financial relationship between Trump and Russian lenders, which is at the heart of, it seems to be at the heart of the Mueller probe, will be in there. It'll be hard to avoid.
Well, it's going to be an exciting 2019. I hope, for all that is sacred, that we don't spend every episode of 2019 talking about Donald Trump unless it's his impeachment or his resignation.
I don't care, honestly. I'm down for it. I mean, we are living in extraordinary times.
Sadistic.
No, it's not sadistic. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying we're going to miss this when it's over, because you know, moves like withdrawing troops from Syria and potentially from Afghanistan are truly terrifying. But this is certainly the most engaged in current events America's ever been in. Americans have ever been in our lifetime. And in some funny way, the fact that people are like so concerned with real matters of state is heartening. I'd rather be talking about Trump than some stupid, you know, holiday movie.
Well, I completely agree. But the thing is, I think that the problem is, and this is my last point, and then I'll let you go because we have a lot to talk about next week. But the problem is, I think, is when you kind of look back at 2018, you've got Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury, you've got Rob Porter resignation. I mean, like each week is something else. The Washington Post reporting that Trump said that certain countries are shithole countries.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
You know, like Secretary of Veteran Affairs withdrawing his consideration for nomination. Kelly Sadler was caught mocking disease. Senator McCain. Like, I mean, we can just go through them, and none of them matter. Like, there's only like four or five of them that actually probably really matter, and most of them were just dumb stories that are just pointless. And what I hope is that we start to kind of sift out what is important and what is not, because if one thing is certain, 2018 was a year where we wasted a whole lot of time on dumb things that Trump wanted us talking about.
Yeah, you're probably right, but let's see what's in the Mueller report. We may have all wasted our time. I'm not denying that, but I doubt that he did.
Yeah, we'll see. Drum roll. All right, John.
All right. Well, Merry Christmas, Nick.
I'll talk to you next week. And just right, FYI, I'm not going to respond to your texts, emails, faxes, or anything until then.
We'll talk about that.
Thanks to my guest today, Jason Fried, and of course, the wonderful, fabulous, soon to no longer have a job in the White House, John Kelly. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. That is me. You can find this on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a beautiful, gorgeous, astounding, amazing review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, and thanks most of all to my sponsors, Dropbox, The New Yorker, and Robinhood. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. I will see you all next week for the final installment of Inside the Hive in 2018. It's going to be a good one. Don't miss it.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS. Just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.